What do you think about the Laker team now?
You follow the box scores of the games every day?
Just the Lakers.
You're kidding. That is really a compliment.
I was pleased to see you smile at the top of our show, because once the game starts, you have a game face. You don't smile much out there.
I don't think you have to do things for money anymore.
Correct.
So the Lakers are on the unlikeliest of winning streaks, winning four in a row, the most consecutive games they've won in 4 years, at what many would argue would be the worst time of the season, considering the draft implications. They now have the third worst record, with two games to go, one game ahead or behind, depending on how you view it, of the Phoenix Suns. They play Tuesday night. They play the New Orleans Pelicans, who are both going to be sitting Anthony Davis and DeMarcus Cousins. So could very well be five in a row, even though Russell's sitting that out. So we wanted to discuss a little bit, discuss this winning streak. And, you know, Darius, what the hell's going on? I mean, why are they playing so well at this point in your eyes?
Well, clearly they've mastered everything, right?
That's right. That's right. Just to tease us before they ride off into the sunset, you know, in their glorious 26-win season or whatever it's going to be.
So, not to be a wet blanket with this, because
yes. A wet blanket?
Normally I'm the cheerful one, right?
I know. I'm speechless.
So, they've played a lot of close games. And in the NBA, close games are sort of coin flip type games, right? That can sort of go either way. You look at the most recent win, you know, they're losing, they're down, and Russell hits a last second three to win the game. And that's sort of been the trend with this. The Memphis game was not like that. The Spurs game was a blowout win, but the last two wins were these sort of back and forth affairs where they were able to pull out close wins at the end. And when those types of games happen, I don't know if you can necessarily point to any one thing and say, aha, they're doing this thing better. Or they won because of this, per se, right? Like, they Sure. played a close game and they pulled it out at the end, which for a young team, that's good, right? But along right. the same lines, I don't think you can necessarily say that this is any sort of trend. They've just happened to win.
I mean, in the spirit of there being like coin flip games, they've been on the wrong side of those too, right? Like the Washington game is one that comes to mind, where
yes.
they were ahead for most of it, and then it was a close game, and they lost that game. But I think it's noteworthy that they're in these games.
Yes. Right?
Whether it's a 2-point win or a 2-point loss, I think there's something to be, you know, I think that's a noticeable improvement in many cases.
Yeah, which is the point I was really going to make with all this, is that rather than looking at the wins per se, I think it may be more important to sort of look at what they're doing overall that's a little bit better. Our good friend of the podcast and of Forum Blue and Gold, Reed NBA, which you could find him on Twitter and at Forum Blue and Gold, who's one of the writers there. He retweeted something the other day, and I can't remember who he retweeted it from, but it mentioned that the Lakers defense has greatly improved since your boy, Larry Nance, became a starter. And Ivica Zubac went to the bench. And I think that that's probably a good place to start as to why the Lakers are doing better, right?
That was going to be my answer, right, is the defensive end has grown significantly. But go ahead. I'll say my two cents in a moment.
Yeah, so I'll keep this short, I hope. but that you insert Nance into the starting lineup, and then with Zubac out of the lineup, and really no other big men, Thomas Robinson has started to get some run. And I think that what you're seeing with this version of the Lakers now is sort of similar to the model that they used at the beginning of the season when they were playing well, which is sort of this grittier second unit that is finding some offensive punch in, you know, less likely places than a guy like Lou Williams, right? Because I think, you know, Tyler Ennis has played a little bit better.
Oh, yeah.
And then Luke has done a pretty good job of sort of staggering his lineups, where either one of Russell or Clarkson is on the floor for pretty much the entire almost for the entire game, really.
Pretty much, the entire game, yeah.
Right, and so, excuse me. So one of those guys can sort of serve as that wing threat and scoring punch, and then they've just sort of improved the defense. Am I off base with this? Are you seeing the same?
No. That's so. A couple of different things the defensive end is exactly where I'm seeing the level of improvement, and the guy who I really wanted to emphasize, you'll be surprised with, is Julius Randle. I think that Julius Randle has been really, really good for a decent stretch of games now. On both ends of the court, he had a couple of plays in the Minnesota game that got my rankles up a bit, but all in all, I thought he's been really good on that end, or at least not really bad.
Right? Yes.
And when you add that to the improvement in his jump shot, I'm starting to develop feelings for Julius. I gotta say,
More whispering. No more whispering.
I know. No. Well, maybe it's a different kind of whisper.
Yeah.
I know.
Sure. Sweet nothings now.
Sweet nothings, man. No. Well, here's the thing I've always maintained about Julius. Right? Is there's very little that he can't do. Right? Like that he's not really capable of doing at a high level. The biggest thing that comes to mind is I don't think he's ever going to be a rim protector. Right? Like I don't think he's really capable of doing that. But my complaints with him have all been things that if he decided to change one day and it was important to him to change, he could be better at it the next day. You know what I mean? And that's what's so dangerous about the idea of moving a guy like him, as I've maintained all along, is his positive attributes are almost irreplaceable amongst a guy of his size. And his negative attributes are not a matter of capability. It's a matter of this is important to him or matters to him. And he, the thing is how long do you wait for a guy to care about that? Because it's not a given that he's going to, right? It's not a given that all of a sudden the light comes on and he plays a position at the four and at the five, depending on whether or not you consider him or Nance to be that guy. He plays a position where you can't be bad. Like you can be okay at that end, but you can't be bad and have a functional team. So moving on from him, it is the difference between Zubats and Nance defensively is about as big as you can get on this Laker roster, right? From one player to the next. I think you could make a decent argument that Larry's our best defender and that Zubats at this point in time is the worst. We all watch the game through, and just in life in general, we all are compelled toward confirmation bias, right? The idea, the desire for all of us to say, haha, I was right all along, right? So there are two things that I am guilty of that in, but I can't help but wonder, right? One, I've been calling for this Russell, Clarkson, Ingram, Nance, Randle lineup since we started floating the idea of Deng and Mozgov sitting down. And that's something that I've wanted for a really long time. And they fell upon it by happenstance with Zubats getting injured. I can't help but wonder what things would have looked like had they gone to that sooner. And then secondly, Nance and Randle are shooting threes and it's effective and it's spacing the floor in ways that make everything operate more functionally. So I think a confluence of all of those factors, along with, I do think that, and I want to kick it to you after this, I do think that the change in the front office from Jim and Mitch to Pelinka and Magic, there's a greater sense of urgency amongst everybody that I've noticed. I'm seeing guys, and the two biggest culprits before were Russell and Randle in this respect, they're competing fairly consistently. They have their lapses, but that's normal for an NBA player. So I think a confluence of all of that, along with this kind of playing for your jobs sense of urgency, has contributed toward this winning streak. Have you noticed an uptick in that, or am I kind of projecting in that respect?
So I don't know if you're projecting or not. I don't know. I also don't know if you can necessarily just attribute it to that. One guy, so before I get into my longer answer, I also wanted to say that Brandon Ingram's been playing really well.
Of course.
Right? And I think that it's... So we talked about earlier during the season how basically every metric that you could point to with Brandon Ingram was that he was this really net negative on really on both sides of the ball, right? That you could see all the tools and there were things that he was doing well within, you know, clustered possessions or a play here or there where you just
flashes,
sort of
right?
were like, wow, like look what he can do. But recently he's been playing really, really well. And and I don't think that you can underestimate how much it matters to sort of put in even like a league average guy.
Yeah, which is about where
into that slot.
Which is a remarkable thing to say about a 19-year-old, by the way, that he's been, even if it's just over a small stretch of games, he's been a league average caliber player, and that's
even
really encouraging.
You know, even in some areas, like a little bit better than league average, right? Like in terms of like shooting percentage, not necessarily true shooting, right? Because the free throws and the threes are still lower than what we'd want, but his two-point shooting percentage and his ability to sort of get to the rim, and he's drawing a few more fouls each game, and then he's starting to understand sort of where he's supposed to be defensively, and it's just leading to more consistent team play as well, not only from an individual standpoint, but how that translates to the team. So I think that that matters.
That's a thing about his game too, and this is something that you've accurately harped on even through his struggles, is that his style of game really fits into a team concept of play. So you're watching, I did a video a couple days ago regarding this incredible play that they had against the Sacramento Kings that ended up in a Julius Randle layup off of a Russell pass, but Ingram was integral in making it happen. And even through his tougher times, and even if he doesn't shoot well, he's going to be able to contribute in a team type of sense, which can't always be said about a guy, you know, that he can go 2-for-8 and have a decent game.
Yeah, it's sort of like, not to be this, you know, negative person about Nick Young, but he's sort of the antithesis of like Nick Young in that sense, right? Because Ingram's handling the ball, he's and initiating the offense, and he's a ball mover offensively, right? And then he's able to rebound his position very well, and all of these sort of plus things that don't always show up in the box score, whereas Young, you know, is like bombing away threes or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And so when he's on, it's like really in your face. But when he's off, it's also really in your face. Anyways, to get back to your other point, one thing that and this is an idea that I wanted to bounce off of you anyway, because you had mentioned that you have sort of been calling for this lineup for a long time. And one of the things that the Lakers have done, now folks have called it tanking, and I know that we can, I don't really want to get into that discussion, but what I wanted to say is that the team as an organizational philosophy has basically removed pretty much every veteran and every obstacle to playing time and cohesiveness that existed amongst the young players. And in a way that has sort of put their development into hyperdrive, right? Is another way to frame it is that they've thrown them into the deep end. And
right. I mean, you can't have a guy like, you know, earlier in the year, if Russell was having a bad game, he just wouldn't play in the fourth quarter, right? He'd play 23 minutes in the game and Lou Williams would close things out, or same would be said of Ingram or, you know, even Randall to an extent. So it's something where, you sink or swim. If you're even, you know, in the game against Minnesota where they won that, Russell missed every damn open shot he had, it seemed, right?
Yeah, until front rimming everything.
Very last one. If Lou Williams is on the team and they're trying to win games, he's not even in the game right there.
Oh, no. Like, I mean, even from earlier in the contest, right, just sort of the and not even early, I'm sorry, but that possession where it was maybe like 3 minutes left and the score was really close. The Lakers, it might have been tied, or the Lakers might have been down by one or two. And they did the, you know, the little ball reversal play where the ball swings to Russell and then Clarkson cut. And Clarkson basically did this cut, but he wasn't even looking for the ball. He was basically doing a flat cut and then he was going to, you know, corner off and go to the weak side corner. And Russell threw that sort of no-look pass to Clarkson. Right. Yeah. So a play like that, if he wouldn't even have, first of all, he wouldn't have even had the opportunity to make that play. Right, because he probably would have been sitting based off of his earlier game performance. But after a play like that, he might have even gotten pulled. Right, there were still, I think, about 3 minutes left. Like, that's plenty of time to get a guy like Lou Williams in to the game to sort of like stabilize things or give him a chance. Right, but there are no more chances for things like that. You could put in Tyler Ennis, I guess, but that's not really going to happen. I guess my point in this, though, is that it's been sink or swim for these guys, and they're learning how to swim. And I think that, and that's reflective of their draft positions. It's reflective of their their collective pedigrees, right? Mm-hmm. These guys were all essentially blue chip prospects. Even a guy like Russell, who wasn't necessarily recruited as highly, but he was still, you know, he went to Ohio State at a Big Ten school, right? He went to a good program. And
yeah, I think he was like 16th or 17th in his recruiting class.
Yeah, but you know, like not one of those elite prospects. Yes, yes.
Right, right. He's not a top five guy. Yeah.
Yeah, he right, exactly. Whereas Julius Randle was like, you know, like the number one or number two prospect, like in his class, and Brandon Ingram was probably in that like top five or six as well, I would imagine. I haven't looked, but that's what I would think. Anyways, these guys are now sort of, I don't want to say given the opportunity, but they are now being put in a position where it's show it or don't, but you're going to be out there regardless, and they're starting to show it. And so whether that's because of a front, like the front office change and they're sort of playing for their jobs, whether it's because, you know, they're no longer looking over their shoulders, whether it's because it's the end of the season and they're maybe tired of being told that they're losers, or maybe it's because it's the end of the season and people are telling them they should be losers, right? Mm-hmm. I have no idea. It could be all of the above, but something is definitely kicking in for them where they are sort of, you can see it, they are learning how to play together. And I think that that really does speak to the argument that you were making weeks and weeks and weeks ago about, like, hey, let's put our best five young guys on the floor together and let's see what they can do. And I think that we're finally starting to see the fruits of that philosophy.
Yeah, right as the season's about to end, right? You know, so.
Yeah, which is fine, though. It's fine. Like,
yeah,
like,
yeah, no, it's a nice little taste, a nice little teaser for next year, although, you know, who knows what happens over the course of the offseason. But before we continue, we have an urgent bit of LFR podcast housekeeping to take care of. It's been brought to our attention over this week that you say right too damn much.
Oh, is that so, right?
That's right.
Okay.
Right? And I think they're... Well, right. And it's even been said that. So I want to know if you want me to have some sort of a mechanism in place to, you know, tase you or some sort of a, wait, should I say left when you say right? You know, just to point out the absurd amount of time that you say that. Or,
well, as a southpaw, maybe I'll start saying left. Maybe
there you go. Yeah, yeah, we're both lefties, right? Yeah. So, yeah, I'm gonna have to find a way. Maybe Tom, this is a good job for you. Is find a way to zap him somehow for because I know this bothers you as well, Darius. It's just we all have our little things, and it's funny for when Darius and I talk. So we record the podcast, right? We usually do it on a Sunday or Monday night, late at night, and we hit stop because we have a certain amount of time that we have to record on the podcast, and we just keep talking basketball for about 20-30 minutes most of the time, and it's just more cuss words really, but you know, it's mostly all the same. So this is one really long perpetual conversation that we have, and you know, we're still learning how the hell to do the whole podcast thing, and I don't really want to be all that polished, I guess, but so, I go ahead, Tom.
So I gotta bring it up because it was on Twitter today, but Pete tweeted earlier tonight this sentimental thought.
Let's get to this later. There's a good question in the podcast on this. Yes. So what I learned tonight was that I can no longer tweet stupid, random thoughts that pop into my head without the wrath of Laker Nation being brought upon me. So
is that a humble brag? Is that a humble brag? So you're.
I guess it could. Oh yeah, because I'm so awesome and popular, right?
What, you're big
time.
I'm
so big time, right? Yes, yeah, yes. Yeah. You know, there are consequences for my actions, right?
That's right.
Anyway, where the hell were we? So yes, winning streak. This is what I wanted to ask: is it worth it? Is it worth losing the 9% that between the second and worst, the second and third worst pick? All of this that you've seen so far, is it worth 8.9%? Is it worth what we've seen in terms of the progress that we've made vis-a-vis the 8.9% reduction in odds?
I mean, that's a loaded question. So I wrote about this from a little bit of a different angle today, this morning, right? Because, you know, I actually saw some fans on Twitter last night sort of bemoaning D'Angelo Russell's game-winning shot. And then they found out that his grandmother had passed away, and then suddenly it was like, oh, well, it's okay now, right? His grandmother passed away, which, you know, I'm not going to get into all of that per se, but I thought it was interesting sort of the pivot that I saw some folks making, where it's just like, oh, well, I can't even be mad about this. I feel good for the kid. Well, you know what? Not to make myself seem all big or anything, but I felt good for the kid regardless. Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Heck
like,
yeah.
Like, I mean, and so you ask if it's worth it or not. I honestly don't know. And that may be a cop out because I don't know if that 9% is actually going to play into anything. You know, these are 9%. This is 9% in probability. Or in a statistical sense, but it's a lottery, and that 9% is basically a cumulative of different percentages tied to different slots, and that 9% is also made up of all the other teams ahead of them and behind them who sort of soak up those percentage points by a percentage point here or a half a percentage point there for them to move into one of the other slots that are either that are in that top three, right? And so is it worth it? I would say yes. And I'd say that mostly
you talked yourself into it.
I did, mostly because the goal of this season, regardless on how much the Lakers win or lose, is really about the growth of the young players. And right now, the Lakers are not winning because Nick Young hit 7 threes. They're not winning because Lou Williams had a 20-point fourth quarter. They're not even winning because Luol Deng and Timofey Mozgov are showing sort of this veteran savvy that are sort of these glue pieces that are holding the team together for stretches. They're winning because in the last 5 minutes of close games, Julius Randle and Larry Nance are crushing the offensive glass, or D'Angelo Russell is hitting a timely jumper or two, or getting to the lane a little bit more. They're winning because Brandon Ingram is turning the corner and getting to the rim and hitting his 2-point jumpers and posting up.
Heck, and Tyler Ennis. They don't win the game against the Wolves without Tyler Ennis.
Exactly. Now, do veterans contribute? Sure. Meta had a nice little fourth quarter, right? He hit a few shots. In fact, and I'm going to call him Meta for that. That was Ron. That was our boy Ron right there.
That's right. He showed up.
Like, yeah. Making some big plays, right? But for the most part, what we've seen are the guys who the Lakers really need to play well for the future actually playing well. And that has led to wins. And I guess you could make the argument, well, I want them to play well enough only to lose. But you know what? One of the ongoing themes throughout, from the second Luke Walton was hired all the way through the season, has been this idea that winning is hard. And one of the things that he's emphasized the most is sort of laying the foundation and establishing the culture where the players not only understand that winning is hard, but putting in the work necessary in order to actually learn how to win. And guess what? The last four games, they've won them all. Has the competition been great? Not necessarily. Have all of those teams been wanting to win the game themselves? You could argue either way. But when it's come right down to it, the Lakers have made more plays than their opponents, and in a couple of those, some really good plays down the stretch of close games where I want them not only getting that experience of playing in close games, but making the winning plays that actually come out on the end. And there's no way to actually get to the point of learning how to win than actually winning.
You can't simulate it otherwise, right? It's the only circumstance in which they can learn how to do it is by actually doing it. And they've been in those situations throughout the course of the season. They've been terrible down the stretch of clutch games throughout most of the season. And they've actually started to make plays down the stretch. And that's a function of the experience and the opportunity and them going, you know, as hard as they can to win those games. So for me, you know, I don't want to convolute the statistics all that much, but what 8.9 or 9% means is 1 in 11 odds, basically, meaning 1 in every 11 times that you were to run this lottery, you'd get a different outcome than you would have otherwise. And for me, that's not a big enough percentage to root against what we're seeing. I can say, in my honest opinion, every single young player that the Lakers have, I have a higher opinion of them now than I did a month ago. They've shown things to Laker fans, to the coaching staff, to the front office. And even if you want to be cynical and say that all they've done is raise their trade value, they've done those things over the course of the last month. And when you have... like those are the assets, those are the people that you have under your control. Even in the best case scenario, even with the Brooklyn run that they had down the stretch, they weren't going to catch the Lakers or Phoenix. You know, it was a 55.8% chance. It's not enough for me to say I want them to lose and go through the really miserable stretch that they did through the, you know, kind of middle 50 games of the season. For me, it's a very clear yes that this was worth it to me. And you know, another bit of perspective is the pick that's really on the line here is the 2019 pick. If they lose the pick this year, they keep the 2018 pick in a really good draft class, in my opinion. And, you know, we say that about every draft class, but I think the 18 class is better than the 17 class. And there's no protections on it. We don't have to sweat bullets about whether or not, you know, Philadelphia is going to get the pick. If they lose the pick this year, it's going to be 4, 5, 6, Malik Monk, Jason Tatum, that caliber of player. And with a chance next year at guys like DeAndre Ayton and Michael Porter Jr., Mo Bamba, you know, Luka Doncic. I can't say his name. Luka from who's an amazing Euro prospect, you know. And now, do we want the Lakers to be a bottom three team as they were this year? Of course not. But even in the 7, 8, 9, 10 type of range, that's you know, I'm fine. Give me those odds. Give me that shot.
Yeah, you're gonna get value. You're gonna get value there. Exactly.
You're going to get a good player there. Yes. Yeah. So I'm willing to, if that's the trade-off for now, the 19 pick that hurts. That I don't want to act like that's no big deal. But for me, you worry about what you have, worry about what you can control. And what the Lakers can control right now is the quality of the development of their kids. And that's something that I think they've done a fantastic job of. And my question to you is, how translatable is this to next season? So the cynical side of me goes, well, this is the end of the season is a very weird time of year, right? Where teams have different motivations that are different than they are in December, right? And it's not something that, you know, you can just draw a linear line from April. Okay, this carries over right all the way to October. But of the things that the guys are learning, in your opinion, how much of this is going to carry over, even in a more existential, you know, person-to-person type of sense?
So on an individual level, I think that any sort of confidence in knowing what works and what doesn't work in key game situations is one of the most important parts of a young player's development.
Very well said.
So I've talked about this with you a bunch, both on the pod and off the pod, but this idea of the sort of development curve and growth cycle of a young NBA player. And, you know, all of these guys, we talked earlier about, you know, these guys being sort of like blue chip prospects, right? But in the when you get to the NBA, at one point in your life, you were probably the best player on your team, right?
At many points of your life.
Yes, yeah. Most of the time. You
in,
know,
in fact, by the time you get to the NBA, you've probably never been the not the best player on your if you're a top pick.
Yeah, if you're a top pick. Well, I would even say this though, that I mean, you know, like if you go to a really good college program, maybe not, right? Like you look at even a guy like this is a bit of a tangent, but a guy like Devin Booker, right?
Uh-huh.
Like Devin,
sure,
like Devin
sure.
Booker went to a stacked Kentucky team. He sure, was sort of sure. held back within the context of what his role was there. And now when he's gotten to the NBA, he's clearly been a better pro than what he was a collegiate player.
Yeah, there are a couple of programs where you'll have that exception. You know, the one that came to mind for me was Wiggins and Embiid, right?
Yes, exactly.
You know, at Kansas. So, yeah, but by and large, these are guys that have always been the best player by a healthy margin on their team.
And then you get to the NBA and it's a whole different level entirely. In fact, it's like not even level implies that like you're dealing in the same plane. They're not even in the same plane. They're not even on the same planet, right? The NBA is a whole nother world. And when you get to the NBA, one of the key things you have to learn is all these things that I was good at before, how many of those things actually work at the NBA mm-hmm. level? And then you actually might go a month or two and think this thing works until people realize this is the thing that you like to do. And then they start to scout you and then they take that thing away. And then that thing doesn't work anymore the same way that it worked even the game before. Right. Because suddenly.
And it's sudden, man. It happens. It comes at you quick.
No, it's like, you know, it's like the tsunami horn, but the water's on top of you. Right. Like that. But that's how quick it can be. And so when I look at what the young guys are doing now on an individual level, them sort of figuring out this thing works and now I have a counter to that thing too, so that when they start to try to take that thing away, I can do this. A key example of this is D'Angelo Russell. So for pretty much up to this entire point of the season, he has mostly been this guy who comes off of screens, who shoots pull-up jumpers, who gets to the lane every once in a while, but basically he's putting guys in jail and trying to shoot that elbow jumper, or he's waiting for a guy to go under the screen so that he can shoot the three-pointer, right? That's basically been his NBA game to this point. But guess what? Over the last two or three weeks, he's been ripping through and getting to the lane, right? A key bucket that he had in the Kings game, he was basically ISO'd right at the top of the key against Ben McLemore. He hit about three possessions earlier, he had hit a three-pointer, right? Which was a huge basket in that game. So what does he do? He gets ISO'd at the top of the key or above the three-point line. He sort of feints the jumper, like not a full-out fake, but just sort of feints, right? The way that a boxer would feint his hands when he's been landing the jab the whole boxing match, right? So he sort of feints that jumper, and now the defender is sort of like, is he going to shoot or is he not? And he didn't do a rip-through, which is like the underneath. He did sort of like the swim-through move where he took the ball and put it over his head and cycled through to get to his left hand, got all the way to the front of the rim, and then finished with a layup right over Papa Giannis, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I think, the go-ahead basket that basically won the game. And that was a play, I wrote about that play actually, and that was a play that he basically has not really made the entire year in terms of that type of assertiveness and that type of strong power drive to the front of the rim. And he's sort of, those are things where it's like, he's figuring it out, what he can do. Like your long rant that you went on about Russell was like, why isn't this kid getting to the rim more? And you had lots of colorful things to say about what he might need to do to get to the rim more, right? But he's doing those things now. And that's just one example, but that's applicable to pretty much every young player on the floor right now, whether it's Nance shooting threes or Randle shooting threes or Nance just shooting it all or whatever, right? And those things do carry forward because guys don't forget what works and what doesn't.
Yes. Yes, indeed. The decision-making components are really what's most translatable. I don't think that, you know, Russell's going to come back next year and be... He's averaged about 20 a game since he's been a starter after the All-Star break. In fact, I think he's right on the nose at 20 a game as a starter, you know, after that point. I don't think he walks in next season as a 20-point-per-game guy right off of the bat. I think there's some, you know, two steps forward, one step back. But I do think that there are, and that applies to everybody, not just Russell. But I do think that there are, along with that, what we also said, the ability to close out games and fight through how to make a play down the stretch and learning how to play with just learning to play with the other young guys. I think that there's a translatability of. Now this lineup of the five young guys has gotten, I think, over 100 minutes at this point. And there's going to that's how you build chemistry. You start to know your teammates and where they like. And those plays where Clarkson makes a back cut and Russell throws a no-look pass to nobody in particular because Clarkson doesn't see it happening, those will happen less and less. And I've even seen there have been several plays where there's been really beautiful chemistry where two guys have read exactly what the other guy was going to do. And that was what you saw in Golden State, where, you know, Mark Jackson kind of raised this group of young guys. And when Kerr came in with this ball movement and player movement heavy system, it was amongst these players that had played with each other for 3-4 years at that point and gotten a lot of minutes, thousands of minutes
in summer leagues too, right? Like mm-hmm. like just a ton of minutes. Yes.
Yeah. So there's a great deal of value that I don't think you lose from that. All that said, I do think that it's different to win in December than it is as a bad team beating other bad teams or playoff teams that want to rest their guys at the end of April. So I don't think they figured it out and here we go. They're good to go from here on out. But I do think that as a group and as individuals, decision-making and reading and reacting is something that can improve. So we're going to kick it over to Tom. We're going to take some of your guys' we had a ton of really good questions for the mailbag tonight, so we're going to try to get to as many of those as we can.
Yeah, let's try to keep it short or, ish.
no.
So, left. Brian right? H. asks, you have 90 percentage points to divide among Larry Nance, Julius Randle, and Ivica Zubac's 3-point percentage next season. How do you split it up?
You first.
All 90 to Zubac?
Steph.
If you can get that's right. I think if you can get Randle hitting it 35 and Nance hitting in the same. Yeah, I think it's less vital for Zubac to be that guy than Randle and Nance. So I'd say 35, 35, 20 with Zubac getting the 20.
I agree.
There we go. Next.
What about 245s? That's just like unstoppable, right?
That's true. That's true.
One guy shoots zero.
Yeah, yeah. Especially if they're going to play together. Right?
Yeah, we're trying to be realistic, okay. Though, right?
Yeah, I mean that's true. Okay, Nacho asks another Zoo question. Taking into account Zubac's physical limitations, both defensively and offensively, can he be a starting center in the league in the future?
Go ahead, D.
Yes, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, like I mean, there's guys just like him. All around the league, you know, they're losing a little bit of their functionality, right? They're sort of becoming these dinosaurs. But Zubac does a couple of things that are needed to be a starting level player at this level. One of them is that little flip shot off of the dive in the screen and roll, and the other thing is that he's an excellent. So three things. The other thing is that he's excellent at relocating along the baseline and finding mm-hmm. open creases to make himself available as an outlet for penetrating guards. And the third thing is that he's actually already as a 19-year-old an okay passer. And all those things I named are offensive things, but when you're going to be that big, the defensive stuff, teams are always going to find ways to scheme you a little bit to make you more of a limited player, unless you're like, you know, a Rudy Gobert type, right? Who's just a dominant defensive player. And so I think to find his way as a starter in the league is mostly going to be because he does just enough defensively while showing more than enough offensively to be, to have some utility.
Yeah. So, we talk a lot about Zubats and use Mark Gasol as his comparison. And Gasol was a guy who grew tremendously on the defensive end between the time he was drafted and his eventual Defensive Player of the Year award. But I would say that we shouldn't look at young players just through the framework of what will they be if everything works out, because it's usually a mixed bag of things that do work out and things that don't. I would argue that he's not currently on the Mark Gasol track. He's on the Enes Kanter track, where he can be a very productive player in and a really good scorer, but in limited minutes as a function of his defensive deficiencies. If he wants to be a 25 to 30 minute guy on a decent team, it's going to be a lot of repetition and film work in terms of the center defensively is similar to the point guard offensively, where he has a lot of reads to make and a lot of reactions and even a lot of communication to make. So he, in those respects, is a long way away, but there's nothing about it that isn't fixable. But it's not going to be easy. He's going to have a while. He's going to have a road ahead of him to get to the point that he needs to get to.
Can I say one more thing about Zubats before we get to the next question? Is that I've sort of heard hints that one of the things that the Lakers want to do with him is really sort of get him in the weight room and get him stronger. So I would say
a lot of baby fat, yeah.
Like, I want him to get stronger, but I want him to continue to be lean as much as he possibly can. He's got a very big sort of trunk and bottom half area, right? Where he's like really thick in the legs. And so I don't want him putting on a bunch of weight and muscle in his upper body. I prefer him to sort of be more of a slender player.
Yeah, as much as I think they're trying to cut some of the baby fat. You know, yeah. I don't know if you saw that board they had up of their body fat percentages, but I think he had the highest body fat.
I missed that.
Yeah. And so he's at like 16.5% or something, which, you know, must be nice for that to be the worst guy of the 12. But he's, you know, got a lot of that baby fat, and I think that's the goal over the course of the offseason is to get him to shed that.
Yeah. Okay.
So David asks, Tyler Ennis has seemingly played well the last few games during the win streak. Do you think any way he can actually contribute next year?
Are those crickets? I think those are crickets, right? I'm skeptical.
It's a matter of contract, right? Now we both start talking like kids. Ennis is an unrestricted free agent. So I share your skepticism in that he, you know, it's over this kind of weird portion of the season, but he's been playing really well. And I also strongly believe that it takes point guards a little bit longer to develop than it takes the other positions, because they're the ones that have to make the decisions. So, as a function of that, is this Ennis coming into his own? He's shot the ball well. There's nothing about his form that I think is fluky. I think he's got nice form on his jumper. He's a good decision maker. He's been attacking the basket decently well. Defensively, he hasn't been bad, you know, but I also think that the Lakers need more defensively in the backcourt, and especially if you're talking about Alonzo Ball or Markel Fultz, if it comes to that, I'd probably be a hard no on Ennis at that point, because I think they'd need at least one guy in the backcourt that's a really good defender early on in his career. But at the right price, I wouldn't object to bringing Ennis back. What about you?
Yeah, I pretty much agree with that. You know, when the Lakers acquired him, I reread his draft scouting report. And basically, the way that he's playing now is very similar to sort of what got him drafted in the first round, right? Mm-hmm. That he's a good enough playmaker, right? And that he's a good enough shooter. Yeah. It's just a matter of him putting those things together to actually sort of be able to do those things at the pro level versus what he was doing at the college level while at Syracuse. Because he was a one-and-done guy when a lot of guys thought he probably should have stayed another year. Mm-hmm. What I will say about Annis, and this is maybe less a comment about Annis and more a comment about young players in general, is that sometimes it does just sort of take a coach to sort of get through to you in a way and empower you in a way that brings out your full game or your confidence. I don't think he's really had that in any single area. There was a little anecdote that got mentioned very recently where I think Luke Walton was talking about Ennis and Nance shooting threes after a recent practice. And he sort of walked by and in that very Luke way sort of said, I don't know why either of you guys are shooting that shot after practice because you're not going to shoot it in a game. Right, like sort of sarcastically, like what's the point of you practicing?
Yeah.
Like what's the point of you practicing?
Take it. Yeah.
Right? And that was sort of his little dig at them, right? Like, okay, you're putting the work in. Now go out in the game and do the same damn thing, right?
Exactly.
And since that time, Ennis has been shooting more threes and hey, it's starting to fall. Right now,
and he's empowered to do
He's
empowered to do it in this like I'm expecting you. You're hurting the team by not taking these shots.
Yes, and so now will that translate to a full season and all this, that, and the other? You know, who knows? But he's been a nice little surprise to me after basically being someone who we look to as and sort of those tank commanders will look to as oh, the Lakers are getting close again. Let's put in Ennis. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And now he sort of flipped that on his head where he had a really good game against the Timberwolves. And I think he played well against the Kings, too.
He's played well for about six straight games.
Yeah.
I mean, he played really well against the Spurs as well. And he's had a good about half dozen games. But it's how translatable is that? I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So friend of the pod, Daman, asks, why is there such a negative perception of D'Lo by the media? And can he do anything to help it? And is any of it valid?
So this is something that Darius and I got into an argument about on Twitter earlier in the week. And I relished the chance to revisit it in real time to talk about this with you. So here, how about you you start on this one and I will swat that crap out of here like Mutombo.
No, so I basically agree with you now. So I've changed my tone.
Oh, come on.
No. So here's the thing is that I've always said, so let's answer the question first and then we can argue.
Okay.
So I think that part of the reason why he still has this negative rep amongst national media is A, he had that unfortunate situation with Nick Young. And the media tends to have long memories when it comes to sort of these immature things that happen with players, regardless of their age.
I don't think that's as big of a deal. Honestly, I don't think it is. I think it's personal. I think that it has more to do with how he treats them. D'Lo's kind of a jerk to them, you know, and I totally understand why he is. I think I have a bit of a similar personality where I'm a little bit like, I don't give a crap what you think, you know, like, you know, you look down, you look up. That's totally something I would say to somebody, you know. And maybe that's part of my fondness for him is he's kind of has this degree of I'm not looking to please, you know, anybody and everyone. But he's the one that kind of lays this bed and they're the ones with the power of the pen and there's nobody to oversee the media and be like, you're kind of being a sensitive little bit about this, you know? There's nobody that says that about the media. And what they end up doing is they transfer their personal feelings for him not being all warm and fuzzy into this idea that he's not playing well. And that's what drives me crazy. Like, I don't mind the idea that he's this kind of whiny guy, or not whiny, but this kind of like this prickly guy to be around. That's fine. Just don't, like, dude's putting up 20-5 since the All-Star break as a starter. Like, stop being jerks about the, you know, inconsistent, can't do anything if he doesn't have his jump shot falling, not improving. Get the hell out of here with this crap, you know? So that's where my gripe is with that. Is I think that we have a pretty unaccountable media. And aside from a couple of guys that will, you know, tell things how they are, I think they kind of without any degree of oversight are able to say whatever they want and project whatever they want under the guise of being objective, and they're not.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, that's going on. That's going on air.
Yeah, we're not cutting that. In fact, nope. In fact, we're going to lift that part out and make a second D'Angelo Russell rant. Just
tweeted at some people who cover the Lakers. How about that?
Oh, man. Doubling down.
I'm tired of it, man. Like, it's this, like,
yes,
air of authority that they're all full of crap. Nah, it's yeah. Stop whispering.
No,
talk.
More. We want more.
I'll wait.
Okay. Harry's doing his Emperor Palpatine impersonation.
Yes.
Here.
Yes. So here's the thing. And here's where we started to get into a little bit of our back and forth on Twitter, right? Is that I think that so I know that you're saying that the whole Nick Young thing, you don't think that has anything to do with it now.
Not but anything. I just think it's overstated. I think it's overstated.
But what I will say, though, is that last year, the Lakers were on national TV a ton, right? It was Kobe's farewell year,
sure,
and all of that. And whenever you're on national TV a ton, national people, TV people, right, they get access to the coaching staff. They're in LA. They have friends in the media because a lot of these guys who are on TV are either media themselves or they've worked around the game for a long time because they're former coaches or former players or whatever. And I think that some of the perception that came out of last year's team, which was whether you want to say that that was Byron Scott or people on his staff or whoever, that there was this idea about what Russell was in terms of, you know, words that get thrown around a fair amount are like petulant or immature, or on or any in that same vein, right?
Can he play basketball?
Yes. And so yes. And so we're not going to disagree on that. We know that he has talent. We know, you and I know, because we've gone back and forth about this a lot as us being two of the true believers in Russell's game and what he can be as a professional at this level. And I think the numbers that he's put up recently speak to that. But I also think the play that he's exhibited even up to this point speak to that as well. Where, like, the per 36 numbers when he was only playing 26 or 27 minutes a night, or sometimes even less than that, that those numbers translate to a point where we knew that this kid could play, right? That said, my point to you was always that there's things that happen that are not on the court that matter. And they matter in ways that feed narratives. They matter in ways in terms of your interaction with your teammates and your coaches. Mm-hmm. And those things matter within the context of constructing an actual team.
Yes.
Right?
I'm really glad we're talking about this.
And,
yes, continue.
And the things that we don't know, we have to know that those are things that we do not know. And we also have to acknowledge that those things do matter. Now, do they matter as much as talent? That's a tricky conversation because you get to a point where you're so good that those things don't matter at all. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, you could be the biggest jerk, you know, to deal with. Your teammates can hate you. You can be the worst sort of, like, locker room guy. But when it comes right down to it, you're so damn good on the court that players are going to follow you. They're going to pass you the ball. And when they pass you the ball, you're going to make plays and you're going to help your team win. Right?
You know, one distinction I think that's important to make, that there have been plenty of guys like that over the years we just rooted for one for the last 20 years.
Oh, totally.
And we, you know, he's our, the prodigal son of Laker fandom is Kobe Bryant. The archetype that D'Angelo doesn't fit into is guys like Kobe, guys like Westbrook. There's a certain SOB factor to those guys. They're like a competitive relentlessness to them that it's like they're these attractive villains, right? Where they will, you almost root for them because they're so relentless. And they're, I mean, obviously we did root for them, but there's even a guy like Westbrook. I love that guy. I love how relentless and just indomitable he is.
There is a force
and
of
D'Angelo
nature.
Isn't that.
There's a force of nature aspect to those guys that cannot be ignored. And
so D'Angelo can be a jerk and nonchalant, and I can see how that drives people crazy. My argument, my counter to this, and not even counter really, but my perspective is a couple things. The Lakers aren't good enough right now for that to matter all that much relative to Russell's talent. He's their leading scorer, their leading assist guy, their leading steals guy, and he's doing things when given the minutes that you don't find many guys at his position specifically that do that at his age.
And certainly not on the team. Which,
no, yeah. Certainly right. Like if you're looking to replace guys on this team, like you don't start with the most talented one or the second most talented one, depending on how you view Ingram, right? But he's like a really talented guy on a 25-win team. So if you're looking at problems, you know, that's not the place where you start. In terms of his, the things, what we don't know, and we don't know what we don't know. In terms of that, how much that matters, I'm willing to concede the idea that he's everything that they say about him behind the scenes. My argument is that it's not time, it's not soon enough, it's not late enough in his career or even in his life development, having been someone who just turned 21 years old, and certainly not in the context, as I said, of a 25-win team for that to matter. Like when it was Nick Van Exel as a 28-year-old on a team with championship aspirations saying 1-2-3 Cancun because they were down 3-0 in a playoff series, like, yeah, that guy needed to be moved. That guy, there were behavioral issues, and Jerry West recently spoke about this, that's the point where, you know, you might be really talented, but we got to move you for Tony Batty or whatever he was traded for because we have to cultivate this team type of atmosphere. But where the Lakers are right now, and heck, don't we see the progress in him from just a maturity standpoint? Even there are things that we don't know, but I see a more competitive guy on the court. I saw a guy in the Wolves game that was like terrible on the offensive end, but had one of his best defensive games and was competing throughout the entire game. You know, I've seen enormous progress from him from in the areas that we view as manifestations of his immaturity. So I don't know, man. What's your perspective on that?
No, I think it's way. So look, man, it's way too early to sort of give up on a guy who has this much talent. And I told, so that whole section right there that you just said, I was nodding my head, you know, feverishly to that, because I'm 100% on board with this idea that how good he is now and the prospect of him only getting better, that is way too tantalizing to sort of turn your back on. And and you have to continue as a coaching staff and as an organization to continue to invest in that and nurture that and try to grow it until it is totally, you are at a total crossroads and you've banged your head against the wall so many times that you know it's not going to work. And even then, if the talent continues to grow, you have to bang your head against the wall even more, the way that the team did with Kobe, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
hey Darius.
Yes. Yes.
So I'm really sorry to do this. We have new constraints because we've got some exciting announcements coming up, but Tom is shaking his head furiously to tell me to end the show because we have to fit into that time window. So,
well, you teased it earlier and didn't give us time to get to it, but I wanted to read a quote from Darius. I don't know if you saw this tweet earlier from 4 hours ago. This is the Laker Film Room tweet. Sad thought. With D'Lo back with his family, LAL looking to make a splash this summer, it's possible that game winner was his last moment as a Laker.
Wait, that's why you were shaking your head at me
right
now? Yeah,
you needed to bring this up. This had to happen.
This is good production right here.
And now we only have a short amount of time, but I wanted to say something quickly where people are reacted to that really adversely, yeah, right? They were really upset. I don't know if you saw that, Darius, but it upset me when I saw it, and I realized that we're upset because we like him, and we'd like to see him grow on the team. And the only way that fans can have a tangible action on that is through your pocketbook. So if you buy that dude's jersey, and I'm not a part of the team, I'm not making any of this money, but I'm not kidding. If his jersey numbers go through the roof in the end of the season, they're going to know that on the Lakers management team.
That's true.
This is just a thought I had, and you know, discuss with the last minute remaining.
Thank you for that insight and perspective, Tom. I like I said, I learned today that I can't say dumb random things that come to my mind anymore, or else I get the wrath of Lakers fans thrown back at me. So, yeah, man, I don't know. You know, he's someone that I totally understand why he's so frustrating, and I totally understand why he has the national media perception, and I think it's a confluence of factors, some of which is the fault of an unaccountable media in the first place. But you know, at the end of the day, he's someone that, you know, like you said, Darius, he's not someone that's I think we're at the point of it being worth giving up on him. So how about you close us out, Darius?
No, so it's interesting because So first of all, what was old girl's name from the Trump administration who said that she wanted like you to go buy Ivanka's stuff? That's how I
felt. Kellyanne Conway?
Yes.
That's how Tom or Kellyanne Conway?
How dare you?
That's fighting words. That's the type of crap you can say when you're in Oakland and we're in Los Angeles.
Right? I felt like, someone's fake. You know, like, oh, you know.
You disagree, sir.
I'm not going to see this money, but you know, go buy the stuff. I heard it's really nice.
Right.
That shiny golden armor.
Oh, man.
From the Lakers store.
That was quite the takedown.
You can go.
That's what you get for talking, Tom.
Man. Do you disagree, sir?
Oh, no. So, I mean, I just want to make one last point is
all right. I'll start playing the Oscars music.
Yes.
Go ahead.
That, like I said before, it's on the coaches to try to get the most out of him and to continue to try every single angle to continue to sort of foster his growth as a player and as a talent, because I think everyone who actually watches the games and kind of knows what they're looking at knows that this kid can play. And I think it would be a shame, very similar to what you said earlier, Pete, about Randall, to sort of see this guy move on and really fully blossom in another uniform, a uniform that you cannot buy at the Lakers store. Right, Tommy?
Yeah.
Amen. And with that, we're gonna end this edition of the Laker Film Room podcast. I am at LFR Tommy. That's Pete at Laker Film Room, and Darius at Forum Blue Gold. And we'll catch you next time, guys.
Just give me a chance. It takes me a little while to get warmed up.
I know it does take you a while to think.
Rebound to Vladdy. Nice rebound to Vladdy.
Oh!
I think that is a cosmetic call, baby.
Okay, kid, you're all right in my book.
Will you get these idiots out of here?